when the market drops and when things change like they do, do all you can to keep your tenants.
Hi, I'm Vivek Kartha, and welcome to Deconstructed. Every episode, we're discussing the future of the world's largest asset class, real estate, through the eyes of the people who live and breathe it. Thank you for joining us, and let's get started. Today's episode is brought to you by Workspace. Workspace has built a better way to manage real estate without all the clicks. With a suite of modern, intuitive products for commercial real estate operators, Workspace reduces the friction between assets, data, and people, allowing CRE professionals to streamline all their daily operations across property management, asset management, and beyond. Learn more at www.goworkspace.com. Hi, everyone. I'm here today with Todd Jurek, principal at Keene Realty down in Houston, Texas. Todd, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Todd, when we caught up a couple of days ago, you talked me through the history of real estate cycles through your eyes as someone with many decades of experience in the industry. I thought it might be interesting for our listeners to hear a little bit about that, and then I want to go into some of the lessons you've learned over that period.
I started in this business in 1986. My father was in the commercial lending business, and so I got to know some of the players in Houston, Texas market over the years, either through, you know, with him through fishing and hunting and other opportunities as a young man and a college student. And I decided with a finance degree that I didn't want to sell insurance and I didn't want to sell stocks, but I figured if I could understand land and money, then I might have a pretty good chance at, you know, real estate or at making a living and succeeding. And so I graduated from college in 1986 and took a job here in Houston in probably the worst real estate market that the country has seen in quite some time. So at that time, anyway, it was a time when laws had changed. They made it very favorable pre-1986 to do real estate deals, and it became very lucrative. And there are lots of incentives and benefits and accelerated depreciation schedules. It just became very attractive. And so a lot of people put money into it, and it was a boom. Lending got lax and appraisals got lax, and a whole bunch of things just, you know, kind of went the course of the boom. And of course, not everything goes up forever, especially when the government intervenes. And then in 1987, I think it was, the Tax Reform Act was passed, and that changed a lot of those really lucrative opportunities, tax benefits and so forth, and depreciation benefits. And of course, taking away passive income losses where we just had a bust, a complete bubble bust. And so with that bust in the commercial real estate market at that time, consequently, several banks failed, 2,000 plus banks across the United States because of commercial real estate lending. And so I did a lot of work for the Resolution Trust Corporation back then. And that was the body that was formed to take all of these failed asset loans and the actual assets that were foreclosed on and have them sold or dispersed into the marketplace. But the value of these assets were sometimes less than 50% of their original value. And so it was a tough time. I mean, it was a sink or swim environment that I got into. And as a college student, I had no idea at the time. So I'm working with somebody just trying to figure out how to keep my desk costs because everybody's scrambling. It was a chaotic time in real estate. A lot of people left that industry. And I was determined to succeed at it. You know, I was given wise counsel that said, if you can succeed when it's down, then you'll be okay when it's up. And so I was going to do all I can not to fail at it. Yeah, it was tough.
I think that's really interesting. You mentioned something about how nothing can go up forever. Does the counter hold true? Nothing can go down forever. I think a lot of the perceptions or the long-term viability of certainly office, maybe retail, is kind of up in the air right now. How have you thought about being at the start of what may be a couple of years of pain in the industry?
not everything can stay down forever because there will be increased demand and opportunity. That's just the nature of our business, of any business. It's cyclical. But one of the things I found and for me to succeed was that the sooner you can face reality, the quicker you can start to recover. You can tell yourself a bunch of, you know, well, I think it'll get better and you know, try to justify why you're holding the course to your pro forma or whatever your model is when the market just doesn't support it. And the sooner you face that reality and realize that you have to make some changes right now, the more likely you are to succeed.
I'd love to hear a little bit about the tactics of that. So in your prior experiences, and even now, you mentioned you have to throw the pro forma out the window, but you've got owners who are kind of being held accountable to those pro formas. That and other things that you've learned and what you might advise others who are going through their first down cycle to keep in mind and how to manage that.
Yeah. Well, that's true. There's a lot of clients who say, well, I have this and my investors expect this, and lenders as well. There's a lot of players that are involved in a commercial real estate transaction. You know, they all have a vested interest. It really takes someone who's been through a few of these cycles to help them learn. Now, you can't, you know, magically change and get everybody on board just because you said a few things. But if you can show trends in history and help them to understand that in this market, when I say throw out the pro forma, I mean, don't be so rigid that you have to get the rental rate, for example, that you pro forma'd when the market isn't giving that to you. If you can communicate that and educate your clients and your lender that, you know, it's in your best interest to not do that. And the reason being is, one, everybody around you that you're competing with are going to figure that out sooner rather than later. And if you do that sooner, you have a better chance of keeping your tenants. Which leads me to my first point that I've learned. My first major point would be that when the market drops and when things change like they do, do all you can to keep your tenants. Because the number of tenants that are available in a down market, the demand for your space decreases. And you should listen to them and try to understand what they're going through as best that you can so that you can help them survive as well. And you want to keep them in your building. It costs less to keep a tenant than it does to find and replace a tenant. Finding and replacing a tenant in down markets is a lot of time. It's a lot of extra money and concessions and so forth. Keep your tenants. You'll end up spending more in the long run if you're so rigid on the rate or the terms that you expect that you underwrote a deal at, when the dynamics of the marketplace in which you underwrote those deals to begin with don't exist any longer. And so I learned that pretty quickly. And as soon as, like with the COVID situation happened, I was immediately talking to some of my clients and saying, we have to keep our tenants, work with them as best you can. Let's not stick to our guns and say, no, we're not going to help. If you do, you're going to end up with a successful project still, even in the midst of a down cycle.
You mentioned something fascinating to me earlier when we spoke, which was in the Houston metro area in that first one. It took about, I think you said, 10 or 15 years to reabsorb all the excess capacity. Given that now maybe occupancy looks different, so financially tenants may be under duress and there may be supply chain issues or with their customers, but also maybe the need or requirement to be in office changes the amount of occupancy that the market should absorb. Do you think that might happen again, where there's a long tail on reabsorbing or getting back to historical levels of occupancy?
I do. I think that now I don't know if it's going to take that long because the dynamics are different. What happened then was the tax laws forced kind of an economic crisis in the 80s. This pandemic-induced crisis was not a financial crisis. You know, it wasn't caused by a financial instrument or some tax law or something. It's a health issue. So a lot of the dynamics going up into that was a strong economy. The numbers looked great. Unemployment was low. We had all, you know, now for Houston, especially, we had the oil industry that was, you know, under duress, and the price of oil dropped substantially. And then we built a lot of buildings pre-2014. And at that time, they were under construction. It was kind of like, oh, crap, we got all this space, and now we don't need these people. And they're literally buildings that were built for oil companies that are just sitting vacant and put on the sublease market. And so when that happens, it depresses everything else, right? Because when we'll just use a number, but let's say a high rise that's at $40 rents per square foot decides that I'm going to sublease it for the next 5 years at $20 rents. Well, what does that do to the Class B building that's a $20 building or Class C building, right? Now it's a $10 bill. It has to do something to compete. And so the whole market gets depressed. And how long does it take to recover that? Well, you know, I don't have a crystal ball, but there are a lot of pundits and people who are experts in the business who think, you know, 5 years at least.
Would like to switch gears a little bit and talk about your experience at Keene starting the business, growing it, and competing against some of the incumbents. I mean, Texas in general is just a red hot real estate market or seems to be a crowded one. So maybe we'll just start with why did you decide to start Keene?
Through changes within the strategy that the company I was working with at the time had kind of forced me to make some decisions. Do I continue going to work for a larger company or do I take this knowledge base? I had run the property management division for a couple of, you know, I'd say medium-sized regional or local. One was regional. It had offices all throughout Texas and would do business in Louisiana and Oklahoma. So kind of an oil patch, you know, what we call the oil patch market. One was more local, but quite large in scope in Houston. And I ran their management divisions. And I really decided when I got to that point, I was happy with what I was doing. And I liked the opportunities that larger companies gave me. But at the end of the day, I thought that for me, the best choice was to do what I was doing for others, for myself. And I really wanted to control my own destiny. I had lost one job due to a changing of a guard or due to the change of a strategy. You know, when a new president comes in, he may want his own executive, you know, his own C-suite. And if I'm in the C-suite, then I'm gone, right? And that's okay. I get that. That's, I think the analogy I use was, you know, football coaches get fired all the time when someone new comes in, you know, or the defensive coordinator, whatever. That's just part of being an executive. But I wanted to control that and stop that if I could. And so I thought, hey, I've been doing this for a lot of folks for a long time. I probably do this for myself. And that's the impetus of why I started Keene.
Well, I'm curious, and I'm sure we have many entrepreneurial listeners to the podcast. What have you learned about competing in what seems to be a crowded space against really large, well-known, well-branded, well-staffed competitors? And how do you win?
Well, that's a great question. For one, it's the expertise that I've learned from the various companies I've worked with and the various clients. Some of my clients were financial institutions, you know, the Morgan Stanley types, or at the time it was GE Capital back in the 80s, 90s, and even up to the 2000s. I had to gain a lot of expertise, but we also had, towards a lot of expertise with the larger financial institutions and what their requirements were, their reporting requirements and so forth. That was a tough learning experience. I'm glad I did it. It taught me, it raised the bar and increased the level of my knowledge and understanding and the analysis that it takes in commercial real estate to be successful at it. But then we also worked with a number of smaller limited partnerships and started to put together our own limited partnerships and high net worth individuals and investors together for complex deals. And that allowed me to take what I had learned working with the larger financial institutions and give a level of confidence and trust to my smaller clients that I can talk to your lender. You have issues about that? I know how to deal with those. I understand what they're saying, because there will be times when some of these folks would be, what are we supposed to do here? What do we need to do? What is my lender asking? You know, what's going on in the market? You know, and I can share that with them and with a high level of confidence and expertise. So I would not have started this business 5 years into it by myself, because I wouldn't have had enough. I found that nobody listened to me for about the first 10 years I sat at the table. You know, I was just a guy who took notes and listened and learned. And then after about 10 years of experience at the conference room table, somebody would finally say, Todd, what do you think? Right. So, you know, to be able to compete, you have to have that expertise and that knowledge and that competence of what you do. And so I learned that. And that's, you know, that's when I realized I could do this for myself is when I made this is when I took the step. So I guess number one, don't go too fast and think that you can do it. I mean, some do, don't get me wrong. But for me, it was gain that experience, learn from others, be a part of something bigger than yourself, and learn all you can before you build up that confidence and that knowledge base before you venture out on your own.
I see a lot of smaller or more boutique firms, whether they're small funds, whether they're property management companies, that are geographically very dispersed, even though they might be only a handful of people. I'm curious, since you've had a lot of experience and time in Houston, you are very focused on the discipline of property management. Do you think that's an advantage? Do you personally think it's helpful to see a bunch of different markets so you have a different point of view? Are both roads to success? How do you just think about the local and discipline-oriented specialization versus see a lot of markets, see a lot of things, and then come back to starting something?
Houston is a large enough market that I could do my work in, and I didn't need to expand anywhere. It was large enough, it was diverse enough, and is diverse enough and has so many opportunities here that I thought if I could focus and be a specialist, one, in property management and some of these sundry, you know, business lines that are associated with project leasing and construction management, those types of things, in this market and know this market very well, that would give me an edge, you know, as a boutique firm over some of the larger firms that may not have as strong a presence here, but most of the large firms do. But, you know, me solely being focused on this market, I think gives me an advantage.
Todd, would love to hear a little bit more about competing with the incumbents through your experiences, your people, and your talent, and how that strategy might look different from some of the larger players out there.
Our firm, being a small boutique firm, has you know, a staff of maybe 15 at the moment. Some it varies in depending on assignments, 15 to 25 people. So we're not huge, but our key people leadership at the top have combined cumulative experience of over 150 years. And we found that to be very valuable because we're not. Our structure isn't a triangle, you know, top down so much as it is more a bunch of circles that interrelate and interconnect. So we're all aware and touch at a high level each other's properties and assignments and duties. And we need that for the success of our business today. When I compare myself to another company, I say we have a high level of personal touch with, you know, really experienced people that provide more expertise than maybe a 20-year-old at a larger company who might get put on an assignment and be basically a property manager in training or an assistant property manager. And they're overseen by somebody who may not interact as much with that client as we would. And so for us, that high level of personal interaction from all levels, myself included, I know every day. We have a huddle every day. I know all the key issues on every single property every day. And maybe others know that as well, but I can then easily say, that's mine. I'm going to pick up the phone today and talk to that person. Or, oh, I've known, you know, I'll get involved or I'll respond to an email. So a lot of larger companies, they don't have that flexibility. Their structure doesn't allow it. So that's I think that's important in how we you know, can compete at a better, higher level than, you know, the larger companies.
I'd like to go out on this question, which take it any way you want. If you could share one lesson that you find yourself going back to at the start of every down market, not specific to that particular bubble or crisis or pandemic or challenge, what would it be?
It's simple, but it's something that I don't think a lot of people do. And I didn't do it at first. I had to learn. Save your money. Save money. When the market is up and you're making money, save it. because when it goes down and times are lean and the transaction volume dwindles and you don't have near the number of opportunities, anybody can make money, you know, when the phone rings. How do you make money when it doesn't ring? And those are lean times. And I keep going back to that, being prepared financially for the downturn. And don't just think it's always going to go up and it's always going to be great. I mean, that's what got us into trouble with the 2009 Great Recession, right? Real estate values are always going to go up. You know, that same thought occurred in the 80s too with lenders and with appraisers. Everybody thought that the value was going to continue to go up. And that's just not realistic. Markets cannot always just keep going up. There will be a correction.
That's good advice for individuals and companies and governments. That's good advice all around. Well, thank you, Todd, for joining us, and look forward to speaking again soon.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for today. Thank you for listening. And as always, a very special thank you to our guests. We'll be back soon, so please subscribe to Deconstructed on Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcasts. More details can be found at www.goworkspace.com/podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by Workspace. Workspace has built a better way to manage real estate without all the clicks. With a suite of modern, intuitive products for commercial real estate operators, Workspace reduces the friction between assets, data, and people, allowing CRE professionals to streamline all their daily operations across property management, asset management, and beyond. Learn more at www.goworkspace.com.